Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
This is Tim Reedy sitting in for Carrie Weber this week, who is traveling, but we are joined as always by Father Matt Malone and my colleague Ashley McKinless. And we've been talking about some of the issues we've been covering in the pages and on the website of America Magazine this week. And the next article we're going to turn to, again available at americamagazine.org, looks at Trump and the U.S. Catholic Church, the first 100 days. And this is written by our colleague Kevin Clark. Of course, there were a lot of stories over the last week about the 100 days of Donald Trump and what has been accomplished, what has not been accomplished. What Kevin did was went through the various statements that have been generated by individual bishops, by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and kind of matched them up to the major events of the Trump presidency thus far. And some areas of common ground, for example, the bishops were very supportive of the president's decision to reverse the Mexico City policy, which prohibits U.S. aid being used to promote or subsidize abortion overseas, but of course always also very critical of some of the policies on refugees and immigrants. So definitely a mixed bag.
Yeah, I think as you would expect in, you know, since the teachings of the church don't align neatly with one party or the other, it's the kind of thing that you would expect. Right. So, you know, back in the early days of the Obama administration, when he was talking about universal health care, the bishops applauded that. And when he rescinded the Mexico City policy, or I don't know, did he rescind it or did he reinstate it?
Reinstate.
When he reinstated it.
It gets changed.
You know, they were unhappy with that. So it's a, you know, and that's part of the living in the wilderness of American politics. If you're a faithful Catholic and you want to see public policies that reflect the broad range of Catholic social teaching.
Yeah, no, and I thought especially their defense of the Obamacare, the Health Care Act, was particularly strong given the amount of criticism that they have, you know, justifiably given over the years with regards to the contraception mandate and funding for abortion. But they've taken a pretty strong stance in protecting the most vulnerable who would be affected if Obamacare was repealed without being reformed or replaced in a strong way.
Well, I think that's a really good point because they recognize, you know, at the level of practical politics that most laws are some mixture of good and bad, mm-hmm. and you have to weigh those things. And they, you know, they didn't like some of the parts of Obamacare, particularly this contraception mandate and how they felt it violated the conscience of some Catholic institutions and so forth. But, you know, when we're talking about, you know, millions of people losing access to health care, if this is repealed outright, then, you know, that moral concern trumps, so to speak, the moral concern that we might have about conscience clauses and Catholic institutions. So I think it's the bishops quite rightly exercising their prudential judgment. And I had never seen, I think, since the 1980s and the activism that we saw among the bishops around disarmament and peace, I don't think I'd ever seen the bishops as a body make so many public policy statements in so short a period of time as they did in the first 100 days of this administration.
Yeah, and unlike with healthcare, they're pretty unambiguous on immigration and the wall. The Bishops' Conference released a statement that said, the construction of such a wall will only make migrants, especially vulnerable women and children, more susceptible to traffickers and smugglers, and the other immigration policies will tear families apart. So they're pretty clear on where they stand on that particular policy.
Right. And they received some criticism for perhaps being too biblical on some of these questions. But when you look at church teaching, certainly if you look at the Gospels, it's pretty clear where the church stands on these questions and has always stood. I mean, even before, you know, was critical of immigration policies enforced by the Obama administration. So it's for the bishops, for Catholic leaders, it goes back to families and keeping families together. And many of these policies are breaking up families. And when you start to look at it through that lens, you can see why people are passionate about it.
And, you know, the Holy Father himself famously weighed in on walls during his press conference on the way back from his trip to Mexico. And he was asked about this proposal for a wall along the Mexican border. And he said, you know, any person that is always thinking and talking about building walls and not building bridges is, you know, not really a person with a Christian mindset, and or words to that effect. And, you know, so there's a compelling moral claim here. And, you know, and the Pope certainly, like the American bishops, isn't afraid to stake out that territory in the debate. Which is precisely why we might need some help making sense of this debate and how we help people to frame and form their own minds and their consciences around these issues. And that's why our guest today is the perfect person to be talking to.
Yes. Again, we are glad to have with us David Dark, who is the author of What Do You Do With the Mad That You Feel, which is in a recent issue of America Magazine. And he is also the author of Life's Too Short to Pretend You're Not Religious, and teaches at the Tennessee Prison for Women and at the Belmont University in Nashville. David, glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, David, maybe you can begin by just telling us a little bit. I mean, you're a teacher, but you're obviously teaching various kinds of classes and with different kinds of students. How did you get started in that? And, you know, what do you learn from it?
Well, I taught high school here in Nashville for many years and eventually went back to school to get the degree to be able to teach college. And before I landed a position at Belmont, I was, as probably is the case with many people we have in common, I was adjuncting my way through life and stumbled upon a thing called the Life Program through Lipscomb University, and ended up taking, I probably taught at three or four different prisons in this case, entering into a higher education initiative that was looking into making it to incarcerated communities. So I've probably taught at a prison most semesters for the last 4 or 5 years.
So what was it like? Yeah, your article goes over like what it was like to teach in the days leading up to the election, but specifically after the election.
Yes.
What was it like in those two settings, like in, you know, with your college students, but also in the in settings of incarceration?
Yes. Well, in the there was an interesting one of the big things that often comes up in talking about teaching in prison and among incarcerated students themselves is the idea that no one is ever only the worst decision they ever made. Mm-hmm. And oddly, there was a lot more compassion for now President Trump among the incarcerated than I experienced with students that I sometimes refer to as free world students. they were worried over both, I suppose, in the incarcerated setting, there is an alertness to the ways that we can demonize people in such a way that we aren't looking at them as infinitely valuable bearers of God's image any longer. So there was that surprise concern. I would say for the free world students, on campus students, it was just an interesting negotiation of watching people feel, most students I should say, feeling a degree of revulsion for the students who presented themselves as supporters of the Trump campaign. And my work was trying to get everybody to hear one another out, to not project their fear on each other. And I tried to be guided, both before the election and after, by the idea that you aren't really communicating with someone if all you've done is shut them down in some way or made them feel like you think that they are irredeemably ignorant. So a very interesting time, especially afterwards, because there was a lot of shock, but the fear wasn't just on the part of those who believed that the world was now in danger of being destroyed by the President of the United States, but also deep fear on the part of those who had voted for Mr. Trump and who had no idea what they were in for in terms of students looking at them with fear and anxiety. Mm-hmm.
David, what do you think is the source of that revulsion? I encountered this too during the course of the campaign, and even today, you know, people who are either pro-Trump or anti-Trump, and you know, I mean, I had strong feelings about these things. I didn't vote for Mr. Trump. I didn't vote for Mrs. Clinton either. But there seemed to be a deep aversion, and the word you used, revulsion, that manifested itself in people when, you know, people would just simply say, I support this person or that person. And where do you think that comes from? And is it more pronounced today than it has been in your previous experience teaching and engaging with folks?
Yes, I think it might be more pronounced today because the stakes are so high, and every day there is something within the news cycle that felt or that would have felt impossible weeks ago. It's difficult to feel trust. I'm trying to, this was a tricky thing even in the editorial process with the article, because a big line is, we demonize when we don't know what to do with our despair. And I think that's true. And I don't want to demonize. But there's also the, you know, the feeling that we have in this infinitely, I'll repeat the line, infinitely valuable bearer of God's image named Donald Trump, that we have a man who seems at this stage incapable of viewing the world and other people as common or kin to him. To use a possibly provocative word, it sometimes seems that he's only capable of viewing the world pornographically, if by that we mean not seeing himself as in deep relationship with that which is in front of him. And that's a very worrying situation. And when we look at folks who we know voted for that, or who continue to be in that pattern of legitimating the underdeveloped male in power, it's hard to not react. It's hard to view one another compassionately in this nest that we're in.
And part of your response to that, which I really loved, is neighborliness, which I think using that term, we often hear about a breakdown of civility and needing to restore civility to the conversation. But I like the term neighborliness a lot more. You know, we maybe have taken a civics class, but we've all been neighbors or lived in neighborhoods. So what do you see neighborliness bringing back to our politics?
Yes, I think politics, righteous politics, is neighborliness. And if we believe, as King taught, that we each exist in an inescapable network of mutuality, neighborliness isn't just a nice thing to do, it's a realistic thing to do. Neighborliness is the most costly realism, but it's also our only hope. We're not being romantic or sentimental when we think of one another as neighbors. It's a call to a deeper realism, as well as a call to bearing witness to God's kingdom and the way we regard one another.
Yeah, it's really more of a properly theological category too, I think. It's,
sure.
You know, that's the word. You know, we don't say that thou shalt not covet your fellow citizen's wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's a within that word, within that notion of neighbor, there is a deeply embedded moral and spiritual claim.
Yes, and the question, who is my neighbor, which is the question put to Jesus,
right,
and put to who is my neighbor, is the most political question we can ask.
Right. Right, and how do the folks that you teach in the different places where you teach approach that question differently?
Well, it is. I'm not always, though. I'm at a Christian affiliated university. My work in the prison isn't considered ministry exactly. It is college credit. It's education. But as somebody who teaches in the humanities, liberal arts, a big one that I'm trying to drive home in even, you know, freshman writing classes or critical thinking classes, seminars, is this idea that we're always in relationship. And it's, we do live in a world where a kind of hyper-individualism seems to be the thing, a worship of impact, of entrepreneurial success, all that kind of thing. And sometimes relationship is the last thing that people want to emphasize. But I do find that with poetry and song and fiction, we can usually get there. And it's welcome news to people because they don't, nobody can have their meaning alone, ultimately. And people don't really want that when we get down to it.
So how do you, one of the things I loved about your article is that you describe the various ways you get into these questions. And, you know, and the argument you're making is that poetry should matter to all of us and that philosophy should matter to all of us. But those fields made for some people who are in prison, for example, seem like, yeah, that's not something that interests me. But how do you get them interested? What are the ways you...
Well, I want to try my best to not should on them terms of you ought to like this or you should like this. But if we can note that poetry is the language, the expression that makes things new, they can look at their playlist. They can look at what they love already and recall that particular lines and particular songs are already in there in their own inner canon, in a way, and note that poetry is something that they're already fond of. And if philosophy is love of wisdom, that's something that they're longing for already, very likely, and that they admire in other people, even though they're not accustomed to thinking of it as philosophy. So I think my number one goal is to help them see that they're already responding to the calls of poetry and philosophy already, that I'm not the one who's dropping either of those on them for the first time.
Yeah, and there's a great Thomistic principle in what you just said. You know, when Thomas Aquinas reminded us that the things we love tell us who we are, and that's what you're operationalizing there.
And that would be part of the angle too on religion, that we often want to disassociate from tradition. We all have a witness of some sort, and our witness is the sum total of what we love or hate.
Right. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We're talking with David Dark, who teaches at the Tennessee Prison for Women and at Belmont University in Nashville, about his article in America Magazine called In the Age of Trump, Can Mr. Rogers Help Us Manage Our Anger?
Now, David, I think we're going to turn to the question we've all been waiting for you to weigh in on, is how can Mr. Rogers help us to manage our anger?
Yes, well, there's footage. It's within the article. I sometimes joke if I'm trying to urge Wendell Berry on people or a poem on someone, I'll say, you know, I think this is so good that if you had to put it in the biblical canon, if you had to put something extra in the biblical canon, this might be it. And I think this YouTube video should be a contender in that discussion because he is he's making a plea for public television. It's the late 60s. The Senator John Pastore doesn't know who he is. And he's saying, you know, Rogers, now's your chance. Speak up. And he says, well, you know, I believe this show involving half an hour with puppets and songs is can be a great gift to the mental health of our nation, essentially. Well, how? Because it shows children. It tries to give this word to children and grown children, that our feelings are mentionable and manageable. And that it's just such a huge, I mean, that's literature to me, that song, that's a good film, a good novel. We go to these things. We binge watch Netflix series. We maybe even watch some horror films in a way in the hope of being reassured that something can be done with our inner chaos. And so in the thick of that, he asked the senator if he could recite a song to him. And he says, sure. And he says, it goes like this. What do you do with the mad that you feel? And just as soon as that question is out there, he stops himself and says, you know, I got that line from listening to a child. And you can tell it's like a soft exorcism. It's like the tables turn because the authority, the real authority, a kind of holy authority, is entirely there on Fred Rogers' end of things, namely because he refuses to view anyone in the room as the opposition, ultimately, or as an enemy, ultimately. So I think that, and of course he says the show itself is a neighborhood expression of care. And that phrase, too, is a helpful way of thinking of all of these little offerings we have, poems, songs, scripture, within the human barnyard, and how we need to collect them and share them with one another.
And in fact, in the article, when you're describing this testimony, you evoke this language, a kind of language that was used for Jesus when you say he spoke as one with real authority. And, you know, I think I'm going to put my cards on the table here. I think that the Reverend Fred Rogers is an American saint.
And, absolutely. I vote for that.
Just one of the greatest Christians and Americans to have ever lived. And he was, you know, early in his career, he said, I saw this thing, television, and he said, what would it be like if we used this great gift of television to broadcast grace to the entire world?
And oh, I just, my goodness, this,
yes. I just think that's the most wonderful thought, right? And it's, but the key symbol for him, as you quite rightly point out in this piece, is neighbor, right?
Yeah.
And when he comes at the beginning and, you know, he opens that show, which I'm sure we all saw when we were kids, and he says, won't you be my neighbor?
Mm-hmm.
He's actually acknowledging that you already are, and he's inviting you to come.
A recognition of a fact.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
To recognize that fact. And you're quite right. He refused to see anyone in that room as anything other than a neighbor.
Yeah, there was a moment years ago when Howard Dean was running, and somebody mentioned that George W. Bush, you know, as your neighbor, and Dean regrettably said, he's not my neighbor. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, it's over for Dean to a degree.
Right.
If you can't, and yet in these debates, I certainly wished that a moderator would ask both candidates, what do you do with the mad that you feel?
Yeah.
And just see what happens. But if they did that thing, too, of speak of the ways in which sense a Democrat is your neighbor or a Republican is your neighbor,
right.
I think that can very much flip the script and change the conversation. But I think the bad behavior or the degrading speech of politicians has been so amply rewarded that it's kind of hard to get back to neighborliness.
I actually wish that Fred Rogers was still alive so he could moderate these debates.
Oh, my goodness.
Imagine how well-behaved they would be.
Yep, that would be fantastic.
And you mentioned Father Matjes then. I mean, he was a minister. I mean, I think that's known by a lot of people, but not maybe perhaps by most.
Yep, he was.
Yes, yep.
I mean, he saw this as an extension of his, really as his ministry. I think he had a congregation for most of his adult life, but he this was really his ministry, and in that sense, he was really the great new evangelist. You know, using television to reach people in a way that he felt was deeply Christian, but was not proselytizing.
Right.
That's right. He didn't have to emphasize. He didn't have to sell it as that. It was just a ministry, a public service. Mm-hmm.
Now, David, do you see other examples of people trying to do this, you know, whether it's on television or on the radio these days? I mean, you're obviously very engaged in pop culture. Are there people, maybe not quite at the level of Fred Rogers, but other people trying to broadcast grace in some kind of way?
Yes, I do feel it can seem like a mixed bag because it's not easily described as completely a worship album, but Chance the Rapper's Coloring Book, I think, does something similar in terms of trying to take the whole of human experience, every stage of development. I think of Bill Moyers as well. I think of Stephen Colbert, who really does bring that, I think, even when he has guests on. I mean, he interviewed the president, trying to do a different thing, trying to be a human being among human beings and model that before the cameras.
So I love all those names that you just mentioned. And it strikes me that in this piece that's a defense of philosophy, you don't mention anyone who we would think of philosophers in the traditional sense. So as much as this is a critique of the breakdown in our political discourse, I would also see it as a critique on the humanities and the liberal arts as they stand. I think they're seen as a lot of people as inaccessible, with not a lot of plain speech going on. Would you agree?
I do, and it really bums me out because I try to open that article with a description of myself at 19 or 20 when the radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh was my guy because he made me feel strong against the intellectuals, the highfalutin, those spaces that I didn't really feel invited to. But in time, there were those intellectually hospitable people who helped me to view thoughtfulness and consideration and neighborliness and critical thinking itself as a joy, a space of joy, a fellowship into which I was being invited. So to whatever extent education or that which passes for higher education is this kind of inhospitable, accusing type space, I think that it's a major failure of vocation for the people who earn their money that way.
Yeah.
And for those who want to know more about Chance the Rapper, you can read Zach Davis's piece for us about the religious rebirth of hip-hop, which we address some of these questions.
That's true. I actually said, I like all of those names you mentioned, and I was like, I actually know some of them.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes, Kendrick Lamar, you also quote in here. Another great
philosopher of our age.
Yes,
that line from his To Pimp a Butterfly, my rights, my wrongs, I'll write till I'm right with God. Just such a, what a mantra to live by. I would have loved to hear the presidential candidates speak on that and to what extent that describes their own self-understanding.
Yeah.
That would have been actually a very interesting question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we started out our conversation by asking, you know, where does that sense of revulsion come from when we encounter someone with whom we disagree these days? So where does the sense of empowerment and generosity come from that if it doesn't come from the Rush Limbaugh?
Yes. Well, to note, whenever we can find commonality, whenever we can recognize that those people whose votes might create revulsion in our hearts are often the very people who are volunteering at great cost to themselves to look after the poor, the marginalized, those who, I mean, like I often, I mean, this is going back a ways, but when Hurricane Katrina occurred and I would get into, you know, in quotes, political conversations, I thought, well, you know, often those very people that you are most outraged by in terms of their voting record are the people who are perhaps schooling everyone else in terms of actually doing the work of getting in there with people in need. So if we can note all of the ways that that abstraction called politics doesn't interface with the real world, we can maybe feel a little more empathy for people and regard other folks as those from whom we can learn, even if our stated positions are different.
And I think that, I think that that's right. And the key, it seems to me, is, you know, once upon a time in our culture, or our political culture anyway, there was a And, you know, part of maybe perhaps this was created by virtue of the fact that we all had this common enemy during the Cold War or whatever. But there was a sense that we could disagree with one another in a civil or charitable way because we had a basic faith that we all shared the same values. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that the revulsion comes when you encounter someone who has a different position than you do. But you're not just questioning their position. You're actually questioning their values, whether they value the same things that you do. And what I love about this symbol of neighbor is that there, it necessarily implies that we do. We because a neighborhood is not just a geographic region. It implies a certain commitment to a set of values.
Yes, absolutely. And neighborhood is a better, I like to, when people speak of the environment, I like to assert, well, why don't we say neighborhood instead? Because that kind of leads to a more incarnate understanding of everybody having a body, everybody breathing air. Mm-hmm. We can't form the word environment without the environment, that thing that we call environment.
Right.
But yeah, any way that we can view folks as bearers of divinity, with libraries of experience that we don't know anything about, that we would do well to ask about even. You can put a question, an open-ended question to a neighbor, rather than speaking in conversation stoppers as we will when we think somebody's just a liberal or just a conservative. I like to say that labels are in so many ways the costliest mental shortcut that we apply to one another.
Yeah, in fact, you encounter neighbors, and when you confront neighbors, it's seen as a crisis or a failure of your being this person's neighbor or this person being your neighbor, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if, you know, citizens kind of locked in mortal combat over ideas, confrontation is the norm rather than encounter.
Yes. Encounter is a very helpful word, like, because we pass by people, we talk to them, we cut them off, but how many people we genuinely encounter in a day is probably a good little inventory to take at the end of one.
You call for these expressions of care, and I love, you have this one line in your piece that you should check this out is my love language. So it's going up to someone and, or, you know, just recommending a song or a book or an article is one way that you can encounter them and share your love of wisdom. So what do you think our listeners should check out in this age?
Other than Chance the Rapper, we're all going to download that after.
Yeah, the Chance the Rapper, certainly. I'll throw in William Stafford's Ritual to Read to Each Other, which anybody can Google and find right away. And I'll note that I'm constantly nourished by the work of Daniel Berrigan, whose words I think I probably read probably more than any other living person. So
that's
the Berrigan Witness.
Is that his poetry or his writings or a little bit of
all
both?
Of it? All of it, the biblical commentaries. I always have Berrigan in front of me. Mm. And he is my big recommendation, I would say.
All right.
Well, he won't do it because he's too modest, but I will add you should also check out David Dark's work.
thank you.
Life's too short to pretend you're not religious, and you can follow him at Twitter at David Dark. David, thanks so much for your contributions to America, and thanks for being with us on America This Week.
Thank you. Very grateful to be a part.
An extraordinary story, right?
Yeah.
What I love about what he does is what you pointed out, actually, which is that he's walking the walk as well as talking the talk.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, I was going to ask him, and we didn't get to it, but like when he spoke at the beginning about what it's like to teach in the prisons, that seems so essential to who he is and what he does. Like, I'm not sure if he could ever give that up, because like everything seems formed by that ability to see people in their kind of infinite complexity, which you have to if you're encountering people who are, you know, the worst among us, if you will, you know.
Well, it's such a good feeling, as Mr. Rogers would say.
Those are
take
our neighbors, too.
Take us out on a song?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, in the words of Mr. Rogers, we'll be back when the week is new. We'll have more ideas for you. You've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. And check out all of the content that we talked about today and our news and analysis of the Church and the World at AmericaMagazine.org. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Ashley McKinless and Tim Reedy, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.